Welcome to the AlphaVille Journal of Film and Screen Media podcast. Episode 3, The Challenges of Separation for Refugee Filmmaking. This discussion between Sue Goldfish and Dr. Caroline Lynette is based on a dossier on the challenges of separation for refugee filmmaking for AlphaVille issue 18 and is moderated by the co-editor of the dossier, Dr. Lucia Sorbera. The recording took place at the Esme Timbury Creative Practice Lab at the University of New South Wales, Sydney, Australia on the 14th of October 2019.
Good morning, everyone. I am Lucia Sorbera and with Stephanie Hemelrich-Donald, I am the co-curator of the dossier titled The Challenges of Separation for Refugee Filmmaking, which is published in the number 18, 2019 of AlphaVille, Journal of Film and Screen Media. This is a special issue dedicated to refugees filmmaking. And I am here with Caroline Lynette and with Sue Goldfish. Thank you for being here. And Caroline Lynette is a senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, and her work focuses on refugees and asylum seeker mental health and well-being, particularly through the use of arts-based research methods. She explores the ethics of participatory approaches and the impact of using art-based methods on local and international policymaking processes. Caroline is passionate about social justice-focused research that opens up new pathways for people from refugees' background to co-create new knowledge. She has used creative research methods like digital storytelling, photography, short films, and music. Her book, Arts-Based Methods in Refugees Research, Creating Sanctuary, published by Springer in 2019, discusses her use of creative research methods like digital storytelling, photography, short films, and music, and the ethical and policy implications of art-based research. In our dossier, Caroline has co-authored an article with Isabel Bloomfield on anonymity and representation, everyday practices of ethical documentary filmmaking. And Sue Goldfish is a producer and manager of the Creative Practice Lab in the School of the Arts and Media at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Sue produces performance and media works, mentors students, and collaborates with academic staff and artists. As an independent filmmaker, her feature documentary, The Last Goldfish, published in 2017, premiered at the Sydney Film Festival and has since screened around the world. It was awarded Best Foreign Documentary and Best Script for Documentary at the New York Independent Film Festival. Sue studied documentary at the Australian Film, Television and Radio School. And in our dossier, she has produced an essay on The Last Goldfish, a memoir about the experience of filming in her documentary. And two colleagues, an historian and an artist, have responded to her piece on The Last Goldfish, Julie Ewington and Joanne Newman. Thank you for being here. Before we start, I just wanted to give some a little bit of background on our dossier, which contains a series of short pieces and visual materials from those who have either made films themselves, like Sue Goldfish and the Syrian filmmaker Rana Kaskaz, or who have used films as scholars and activists working in collaboration with people of lived experience. And this is the case of the essay by Isabel Blomstein and Caroline Lynette, but also Mandy Hughes. These writers discuss the questions of ethical and personal narratives and the ways in which certain stories, arcs present themselves as indicative of a time, a place, or a kind of experience. They consider ideas of visibility and invisibility, and the short-term memory and long-term impact. The separation in the title for this dossier refers to the separations by reason of war, by time and generation, or by experience. Stephanie and I were very much inspired by the reality we were observing around us when we conceived this dossier, but also the connections between the present days and history. Refugees are a matter of this day, are a big issue, political international issues in these days, but the plague of being a refugee, the experience of being a refugee, has also an historical dimension. And Sue, in your documentary, you have deep and explored this historical dimension, both on a personal and a broader way. Can you say some word about that?
I think the project that I embarked on many, many years ago about my family and my father's experiences in particular, you know, at the time didn't necessarily have a particular focus. You're just doing the research and kind of trying to find what the story is. But by the time the film had finished, it was very much centered in the current politics around refugees, refugee law, the way that governments can aid or can actually make everything a lot worse for individuals. So looking at my father's experience, where so much of what happened to him was kind of luck, trying to break that down into, besides luck, what were the things that meant that he survived this terrible, you know, genocide in his family as a Jewish German man? And so his traveling from Europe, this, you know, the place of this fascist government that had come in and had designated his family as being other and not, you know, part of the German state anymore, meant that he lost his citizenship. So he became a refugee because somebody didn't want him anymore. And then he goes off into the world, like, looking for basically a new home. So then along, you know, comes luck. There's a ship. The ship happens to be going to Trinidad. And he could have at that point gone to Trinidad, he could have gone to Shanghai or even Australia, but Australia would have taken months and months and months to be able to even get an opportunity to come here. Shanghai was getting more into the war that he could feel was coming. So he gets on a boat and he goes to this tropical island. And he lands as someone without citizenship, but he feels safe. And he's there with his first wife, a young woman that hardly knew each other. It was kind of convenient that they could share this ticket to get out. So the film very quickly became around these things that were structural that governments did. So what the British authorities did in terms of opening doors to let people in, but also when people closed doors. So my father arrives on New Year's Day, 1939, and 12 days later, the British shut the doors, and it means that refugees are then turned away. So these moments, and you can see if he'd been, you know, if it had been the 13th of January, where would he have gone? Like, he could have, he wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have any idea about where he would have gone. But he arrived 12 days before that judgment was made, that law was changed. So it becomes, even though it's a personal film about the impact of having that kind of history in your life, it still resonates within this current political environment where things are being manipulated constantly and people are being manipulated. So, yeah, I was very honoured to be part of this dossier. Like, it was incredible to be part of this. So I hope the story, yeah, added something to the conversation.
The silences play an important role in the history of in your family history, in the history of your father. I was very much touched by the the personal journey you made discovering the family history. You start by saying it was only the three of us in Trinidad, and this "it was only the three of us" recurs also in your life in Australia, referring to you, your mother, and your father. Mm-hmm. And only when you were a teenager you discovered that there was another family, and later on you try to find other members of the family. Mm. And by the end of the film, you're surrounded by a number of sisters and nephews and cousins. So how much do you think silence is a shared experience in refugees' families?
Yeah, I think that, you know, differs from family to family. But I think silence is a very useful tool for people who have gone through trauma. One, that they don't want to revisit the trauma. But I think mainly with my parents, it's about protecting me from this terrible history. So they just don't mention family at all. So my mother is not Jewish, she's English. She had a very small family. She also doesn't really talk about it. So it's like, you just grow up as a child thinking this is it, this is what family is, it's, you know, my parents, that's it. And then the neighbourhood is your family. And it kind of, you know, then stretches in Australia when I start, you know, when I came out as a lesbian, and the community then grows into the gay and lesbian community of Sydney, but it's still just my parents as, you know, the blood mm. family. But through it all is this, you know, as soon as I realized that my father had another family, that he said he didn't know where they were, which was actually a complete lie. Again, you know, he tried to silence my search. He tried to stop me. He tried to say, no, there's no point. You won't be able to find them. I don't know where they are. You won't be able to find them. And again, it's because he doesn't want this thing to open up. So everything is about containing it, not letting the story kind of leak out, because if it does, who knows what will happen next? You know, what will happen to him? What will happen to me? What will happen to the other people that are part of the story? So everything in our family became more and more just this contained little unit that no one would break. And until I started discovering things, and in an odd way, my father left clues. You know, he wouldn't say things, but it's not like he tore up all the photographs. He didn't tear up stories. He actually wrote things down. He just kept them secret. He had photographs that just didn't have names on the back, but they meant I could ask questions. So, it was an interesting thing of this, I think, desire to actually tell the story, but a fear of what starting that conversation might mean. Yeah.
Mm. Caroline, how much of these experiences of, you know, traveling and recovering silences and filling the gaps of silences do you find in the artworks you study and you analyze?
I think for us as arts-based researchers, the silences play an incredibly important role. It's silencing by governments, it's silencing by depersonalization and making people invisible. And so for this movie, so for Isabel, it was incredibly important that the story of a young woman, and it was important that it would be a woman, would come into contrast with this large-scale silencing that's happening nationally but also internationally. The journey of someone who is seeking asylum in Australia never ends, and this situation of ongoing limbo and what it means for a young woman who wants to study and wants to work and wants to build a life here, it was really important to say that it's unacceptable actually to put people in this situation in this stone age, and to be able to use her voice and her story to say, I want to share my story with the world, even though the structures and the government of the day are stopping me from doing that. So from that perspective, collaborative filmmaking can be quite powerful if done in the right way to open up an area of conversation that's actually missing and that's deliberately missing. And so when I mean to do it in the right way is to find strategies that means that we're not complicit to this silencing. So what happened in the first instance when Isabel and I started discussing how to film this story to make sure that Asiya's privacy was respected for safety reasons, is that we found ourselves going towards the strategies that were depersonalizing, so filming her shadow or trying to blank different parts of her of the visual so that she wouldn't be identifiable. And so our first struggle is that we did recognize that we were committed to the social justice outcome of filmmaking, but the strategies that are available are quite limited. And so we were contributing to the very thing we were trying to challenge. And that was a struggle for us. And we've sat down together and discussed this for many hours to figure out better ways of not only doing justice to Asiya's story, but also sharing her story in a different way that people perhaps don't expect, but in a way that that makes her recognizable without being identified. And so that was a huge challenge, to respect different parts of her story and keep in mind why we were doing it in the first place. So was it to say that we did a film? No, it wasn't about this. It was about giving Asiya a platform to speak about what she wanted to speak in a culture of silencing.
And can I say that I hadn't seen it before this morning, and to me it's a very successful little documentary because it's incredibly intimate. And I was saying it's like it always teeters on this intimacy, so you catch little glimpses, so you really get a sense of the shape and the look of this person without ever actually seeing them. But at the same time, her voice, it's really strong, beautiful voice, and the way that the story is edited, you get such a strong sense of her that you in a way don't even notice anymore that you don't see this person's face, you just see an occasional cheek bone or, you know, a little tiny touch of the nose. So it ends up being very intimate and quite special. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yes,
and thought it was very effective.
It's very skillfully done. And Isabel and I are both very conscious of the fact that we can both be identified as authors of this article, and yet we cannot use Asiya's real name, even though it is based on her story. So we're very much aware of the injustice in that process. And so it's great to hear feedback that short video is actually challenging the very fact that we cannot name her.
Yeah, it was very strong.
Yeah, and there is this theme, you know, all over your article and the film of, you know, the challenge between avoiding the depersonalizing tropes and while protecting the privacy. Refugees are seldom named. They in master narratives they tend to be numbers, statistics, or facts. Instead, in the works that we have collected in this special issue, we try to recollect individual stories and to make sense of them. Like, can art produce a counter narrative to the mainstream narratives of history?
Because I think, you know, the whole reason I wanted to make this film was to make a difference, to tell a story that made people think differently or challenge them in some way. And I think one of the things ultimately at the end was to try and give people a film that would generate empathy, basically, so that you would make the connection from, you know, this personal story of a young woman who's kind of, you know, through 40 years goes looking for these disconnected, disparate family that's all over the world and pulling all these threads back together, but at the same time thinking, well, you know, that's the impact of that experience of fleeing war. That's what happens. People get lost and they also get silenced. There is shame around going through those experiences that you had to run away, that you failed, or that your family died and you're the one who survived. It's so complex, that silencing. So the telling of a story many, many years later, I just really hope that people would kind of make that connection back to the experiences of people now who are fleeing for their lives. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a passage in Rana Kaskaz's essay. Rana Kaskaz is a Syrian filmmaker who is currently based in the United States, but between 2013 and 2015, she moved between Syria and then the United States, then Jordan, because her and her family wanted to be closer to Syria, and it's very powerful when she writes that suddenly her and her husband, who's a filmmaker himself, realized that they were not filmmakers anymore, just filmmakers, but they were refugee filmmakers.
Yeah. I find that quite exciting, actually, this challenging to, say, the field of refugee studies broadly, because we're coming up with such narratives after decades and decades of people who haven't experienced forced migration making films about or on, rather than in collaboration or as part of a lived experience. I find that crucial, actually. It's high time to have a more diverse group of filmmakers, especially women, who are actually saying, no, it's actually my turn to tell this story. It's personal, it's subjective, and not apologising for it. And I think that's what's been missing from the conversation, and that's why, from a research perspective, refugee studies can be quite impersonal, biomedical, and we're actually saying, no, this is only one part of the conversation. There's a big piece of the conversation that's been missing, and so stories like these are coming in to challenge us and make us uncomfortable and make us question everything, even though we think we might be doing well. But there's a concept that's called haunting. So it's that feeling that after you engage with any form of art or research, that you're left with that feeling that something needs to change or something has changed. And I think that's what's happening with the films we're talking about, is that people watch them and they're no longer the same. Once you know something, you can't unknow it. And I think that's where filmmaking in this space is incredibly powerful and useful, because it forces everyone to look at things from a different angle.
And for the artists themselves, the filmmaker themselves, like particularly with that subjective, very personal storytelling, like your subject, you know, that must be such an empowering thing to have, you know, had that experience of bringing something into the world, protected, but, you know, powerful message.
Yes.
Like, how did she feel about the film? Did she see it? Could she watch it with other people? And
she did the collaborative editing with Isabel, so she had a really strong say into how things were framed. I think from the very beginning, Asiya really saw herself as someone who could speak, because she realised that many people around her, especially in detention, but also from her country of origin, could not speak. And she saw herself as a young woman who almost had a responsibility to speak through filmmaking. And so she did enjoy the challenges of deciding what to film, how to film, what to include, what to exclude, because she saw that as a really powerful way of claiming her story. And I think that's a really important part of this whole, you know, national and international discourse that we're talking about, that people do not have an opportunity to claim their story, the good and bad of everything that they've experienced.
Mm. Yeah.
Mandy Hughes, who contributed with an essay, but she also produced a documentary about a group of refugee women, raises a question about what is the benefit for the participants in this kind of projects. Have you asked yourself these questions while you were filming your family or as a year?
I think one of the benefits is that we're asking people to talk about or to share something that they know very well. In a context, say, like in Australia, where we're constantly asking people from refugee and asylum seeker backgrounds to acquire language, get a job, get an education, be an active member of society, whatever the benchmark may be, that if there is a space where people can actually speak in their language, they can talk about their culture, they can talk about their family history, they can talk about the things that they know best, it's incredibly enriching, not just for them to realise just how much they actually know and can share, but also for us as collaborators from academia and the film world to be able to say, we're here to be led by you and not the other way around. So in my book, I call my co-researchers knowledge holders, because I truly believe that in collaborative filmmaking, you know, people with lived experiences are the people who hold the knowledge, and we're mere facilitators to document it in many different ways, written or visual. And so that in itself can be incredibly liberating for the people who are at the centre of stories, like in Mandy's film, to be able to talk about food, something they know super well, in a context where perhaps the food culture is alienating. The subtitle to my book is Creating Sanctuary, and I can really see that in the way that Mandy has talked about, has placed value on the food culture, that it's creating a little sanctuary. It doesn't resolve all of the issues around people. Issues can be really complex. But to have this moment when we're saying, what you know best, that's what I want to know about. That's what an audience wants to know about the most. I think that's a fantastic opportunity. And it's a privilege to be part of that journey.
And Mandy's film made me hungry. It was like the most delicious things being cooked constantly, and the joy around all of that cooking. And you can really tell how relaxed people are, because that's the thing when you're filming people, that moment when they really forget the camera's there and you're there and they're being themselves, it's great. Yeah, it was another really enjoyable film. Because I find with my film in terms of academia, the thing that was quite magical that happened for me, and thank you, Google, because I'm constantly would be searching for Jews Trinidad, and one day up popped a researcher in England who just finished her PhD on the British West Indies and the Jewish refugees, and her whole PhD was about the actual detail of how those refugees got there, what role the government played in that, the colonial government, but also the impact it had on those colonial communities. You know, Trinidad is at that time was still a colony and had this, you know, really shocking history of slavery and indentured labourers, and so this very black mixed population suddenly gets, you know, a whole bunch of Europeans who often were really racist themselves, even though they were fleeing racism. So all those cultural clashes and the impacts that had on that little community, and, you know, the way the British dealt with that, all of that stuff's really, you know, amazing. And so Joanna being that, my collaborator in a way, my story brought her PhD to life, because I could give her a generational kind of breakdown of what happened next, you know, to people. And we're still kind of working together, which is how she ended up writing in with the journal. I kind of needed that, because the personal storytelling, that was my job. My job is to make an affecting story, to affect, you know, bring this affect on people. But her job was to give me that solid sense of understanding my father's experiences and keeping it in that kind of research truth as much as, you know, it can be. Mm. Yeah.
And there's something to be said about looking back and looking forward. Mm. So I guess in your film there was a lot of looking back and looking at the present and the impact. And I'm trying to think about what it's going to be like for Asiya in a couple of decades, and how she's going to have this incredible film to look back on and to see, you know, how much she's travelled from this point onwards. But as it's also like it's a memory of how life was for her around now, But for the broader audience, it's a documentation of what life was like and how we treated asylum seekers.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in 50 years' time, when people look back on this time, what are they going to say? And what are they going to think about us and our decisions and our ways of doing research? Like, we can't be smug because we can look back and criticize others. But I've always got that at the forefront of my mind. What are people going to look back on? Are we going to be proud or are we going to be ashamed? And I think filmmaking is a really important part of that conversation. What kind of documentation are we leaving behind about our ways of talking about forced migration, about women's stories, about policies that they're going to have long-term repercussions, and we're going to be responsible for that. Yeah.
You've been listening to a discussion on the challenges of separation for refugee filmmaking, featuring Dr. Lucia Sorbera, Sue Goldfish, and Dr. Caroline Linette. This podcast is produced with each new issue of the Alphaville Journal of Film and Screen Media. Alphaville is a fully peer-reviewed, open-access, online journal edited and published by staff, PhD and postdoctoral researchers in film and screen media at University College Cork, Ireland. This podcast, along with every back issue of the journal, can be found at www.alphavillejournal.com. Thanks for listening.